obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
All right, my name is Jim, and I am a grateful member of the Al-Anon family group. I want to thank Dave and Denise for actually asking me to speak, because this topic is very difficult for me. Most people come in here and say, wait, why am I talking? Because they react and talk. I'm just the opposite. I do not talk. I see a situation, I look at it, I assess it, and then I don't say a thing. So for me to wait, why am I talking? I can relate to, wait, why aren't I talking? And so it might be a different twist on weight as to my perspective on it. And this goes back a long, long time ago when, I guess, through generations, my ancestors, my father, grandfather, great-grandfather were all farmers. For many, many generations, they farmed. And what happens on a farm? You get isolated. You're alone. You don't have neighbors. You don't have friends. You're not in a city. For them, you might not see everybody for months. So talking wasn't the priority for them, even for my father. He was 43 when I was born. We were living on the farm that he had got from his dad. And his dad was 49 when my dad was born. And my grandfather there got that land in the Oklahoma land rush in 1893. So it goes back a long ways for just to my grandfather. So they lived on this farm. My dad was born on this farm out in the middle of nowhere where they had to put everything together, settle it. There was no towns. And my dad grew up like that, you know, and 43 years later when I was born, it was still sort of an isolationist there, you know, that we only went to town on weekends. My grandmother was there too. She was with her family and her three brothers and father. They were in the land rush too. She actually fell off the wagon about a mile and a half down from where my grandfather got his. She says, "This is my land." She died at 96, still on that land. You know, it's just that type of thing that we did not communicate as to the way modern families do. So I think when I was born, that's the way I was raised, you know, mature adults. So my dad really didn't say too much when I was growing up. And it was okay, you know. I went to school there. We caught the school bus, one bus for the whole school. There was eight kids in my class, eight. It was a four-room schoolhouse that I went to school in. So I didn't have the next door neighbor that we went to school afterwards. We came down and did chores. That was it. It was hard for me to really get out and communicate. And I think I was 10 when, you know, we're living in Tornado Alley in Oklahoma. And here comes, you know, one evening, you know, all of a sudden the house is shaking and everything else because the wind's blowing and a tornado comes through. You know, you get up the next morning when it's daylight and you see that the house we're in was moved off the foundation. It really couldn't be put back together. It didn't get destroyed. We were okay. But at that time, my dad said, "I think it's time we move." So, you know, at 50-some years old, he picks up and we come to California. His brother had come about 10 years prior to that. So we moved to Redlands, California. Here I am, 10 years old, coming to Redlands. Go to school that fall. There's three classes of fifth graders. That is a big shock for me. You know, how do I adjust coming from such a small area? You know, they bought a house in a little suburb of Redlands on a little, what I call a postage stamp lot, where there's people all around you. It was a shocking thing for me to experience because I didn't know how to maybe interact with friends and make friends that way. You know, all these other kids around there playing and jumping around and everything else. That's something I really never experienced before. So it was difficult in that. I don't think I had a true, what I call a true friend, even going through, you know, junior high and high school. I had associates and stuff to hang out with. But having a true friend, not really, you know. But I think I did get out of my, from my family, is that work ethics, you know. That was what it was about for me. And I was saying, having mature adults for parents, we sort of missed a generation in there. Didn't have the 20-30-year-old parents raising us. And maybe some of that excitement and enthusiasm that they would normally have shown when they were in 20-30 didn't get rolled into us. You know, I had two sisters. That was my friends. So it was a little difficult making friends and going to school, but I did okay. It was all right, and I got through high school and did meet a girl, and we got married in 1969. But that was also a rough year. Got married. My dad died in 69. We had our first son in 69. You know, so that was hard transitioning through that. All of a sudden, I lost that father figure. Who's going to guide me, you know? Even though it didn't say much, but there was this inspiration. So all I had to go on was my knowledge, what I had, you know, 21 years old. So for me, it was work. And that was my way of saying, hey, this is what I do for my family. So go to work. Become a workaholic, you know. find these jobs that... We're 7 days a week, you know, doing that. When I was in college, worked at a pizza place, delivering pizzas. Ended up working there, managing that. Then, hey, after hours, hey, pizza's closed at, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night. What do you do? Well, hey, let's pick up a paper route. Do that 7 days a week. Ended up buying a LA Times dealership out here in the desert in 1976. Well, that's 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. You know, that was my life. By that time, we also had a daughter. So I had two kids raising a family. But my whole thought of family life was taking care of them. I don't think I was there emotionally for them. And that made it rough. But I continued and working and striving the best I could. And I think in 85, we bought a restaurant in San Diego. So we need a change from the desk, go down there. And at that time, things just sort of falling apart with the family. Maybe we've pulled apart so far that it is time to make a separation. And that's what we did. We separated at that time. The kids went with my ex-wife, and I went on my own way, sold the restaurant, and eventually came back here to the desert. Fine and dandy. I'm okay with that. And now, you know, I'm almost 40 years old by myself. And as I've been saying all along here, this was me with my work ethics. Not once was there alcoholism in my family. So I'm 40 years old. I don't even have anybody that I can associate in my family with. And I've done a lot of thinking back over the years. Was there an alcoholic? Was one of my uncles, anybody that I could recall? But being on the farm and then coming out here, I didn't know my relatives that well, but I cannot recall ever being associated with what they call an alcoholic. So my vision of an alcoholic was, like you said, somebody down on Skid Row, a bum or a derelict or something like that would be the alcoholic in my life if I had one, but I didn't have one. So that's okay. You know, my son, I think today he might be an alcoholic. I do not know. I communicate him emails back and forth and see him every now and then. They're up in Central California, so don't get to see him too much. But he ended up having three marriages and three divorces. He's got six kids, so six of those are my grandkids. We see those grandkids quite often. This last May, we actually went back to Georgia to see my 19-year-old grandson graduate from Fort Benning boot camp. That was his goal. He said, I can't do school. I want to have a career. So he went into the Army. He's stationed in Germany right now. He's seeing the world. My daughter, she left about a year after my wife and I split. She said she just didn't want to be with us any longer. And I talked to her maybe once every 2 years via email. She's got two kids. I've never really seen those two grandkids except when they were 2 years old and newly born. She lives in Liverpool, England. So my family, like I said, up to that point, I was okay because that's the way I was raised. You know, you're sort of by yourself. Everything's all right. And then what was I doing? Came out here, needed something to do, so I bought a taxi. Yeah, let's be, you know, a taxi cab. Do that for a while. You know, I knew the whole area by having the dealership. I knew every street in this valley. So it was real easy to fill into something like that. And sure enough, there was another taxi company in the town and up there someplace. And sure enough, here comes this gal. And she's full of fun and life. And she has no care in the world. But she's up there driving a taxi, you know. And so I do meet her, but I had no clue what alcoholism was and that she was an alcoholic. So I end up, you know, falling in love, marrying an alcoholic and not knowing it, you know. And I'll tell you, I lived with an active alcoholic there for about 15 years and still not knowing what the disease of alcoholism was all about because I had no clue. It was okay. I knew she drank. I knew she drank now and then. She would try to stop drinking and go for times. And why am I talking? I'm not talking. I'm not telling her, hey, stop or we got to do something else. I'm not saying anything, you know, because this is me. I don't talk. So we did this for quite a few years. She had two daughters. And one of the daughters, was just married and had a little girl, and she moved back to Texas. But over the course of that 15 years, that one granddaughter, she came to live with us back and forth for about four different times, 2 years here, 2 years there, back and forth, you know. And I can't figure it out. What's going on here? This family is dysfunctional, but I'm not knowing why. And I'm getting so upset, but not saying anything, that why is this happening? Why is this daughter putting this granddaughter on us? Why do we go through this, you know, and having that resentment towards that, you know? And I just couldn't figure it out, you know? And then, my wife says, you know, I'm trying to cut down. I'm only drinking wine now. Wow, that's good. Now she's getting better, you know? She's only drinking wine. It's okay. I was okay with it. You know, a functioning alcoholic. How did I know? You know, in 94, she went to school, got a certified travel consultant, CTC, travel agency. She bought her own agency in 2001. She's a functioning alcoholic, and I'm not knowing that, you know. In 03, she takes her desk from the front part of the office and moves it to the back. She says, I didn't want to associate with too many of the clients. Well, how did I know? It's because you could drink easier in the back and not be seen. You know, I don't put things together like that because here I am, you know, 40-something years old, never associated with it. That was an eye-opener when I finally saw the light that maybe she had a drinking problem. And I still did not know how to address that problem, because why am I talking? I'm not. So not addressing it, it just went on like that for years and years, and slowly the disease of alcoholism got worse and worse on it. And I think the turning point for me was that her younger daughter was getting married in June of 2007. And this was in March of 2007, and the in-laws were over, and they were discussing the wedding plans, right? So they're in there discussing the wedding plans, and all of a sudden, I'm sitting there listening to this conversation, because there's all four of us in there, and all three of them are in there discussing, well, what would be the best color to put in the vodka to make it go with the wedding and all this... all the decor, and they were having such a good time, and I'm standing there saying, wow, what is going on? That this is their priority over a wedding is the color of the vodka for the drinks, you know? And for that reason, I had that moment of clarity that says, wow, I just cannot do this any longer. Maybe there is something there that I'm not getting, that alcohol is something I cannot deal with. And I did make that decision at that time to speak up. And I said, I cannot do this any longer. Something has to change. I did not know what was going to change or how to change it, but I knew at that time for me, something had to change. And I don't know whatever reason it was, whether it was God intervening or maybe my wife having a moment of clarity too, but she says, yeah, we do have to change. She didn't walk out the door. She didn't leave me. She actually called a friend of mine who was in AA and asked if she could go to a meeting. And so she did. She started going to AA and really trying. And she went to AA for about 2 months, you know, and working the program and all that. And she comes home one day, you know, and says, you know, wow, this is a good program, AA, but, you know, we're taking that trip to Paris and that Mediterranean cruise in about a month. And, you know, I cannot go to Paris and not drink. But, you know, I'll come back to AA when we get back home. And I go, well, thanks for being honest. I appreciate it. Good. You know, not knowing what the disease of alcoholism was all about and how AA worked or anything else. But she always says it's her demise, because about 2 weeks later, she said, you know, there's a program for you. It's called Al-Anon. She says, why don't you go to Al-Anon? And being me, saying, yeah, sure. I will give Al-Anon a chance. So I think it was May 10th of 2007. I looked down the line, found, oh, there's a meeting tonight, Tuesday night at the Alano Club in Yucca Valley. So I walked through that door for the first time into Al-Anon. What got me was a gentleman across the table when I walked in, named Tom. I never knew these people. There's only like six of them in the meeting. And the only thing that I got out of that first meeting was Tom. He just said, make a commitment. I go, what's the commitment? He goes, six meetings. Give Al-Anon six meetings. That would be your first assignment. You're not going to get anything out of anything what anybody says for the first two or three meetings. But make your commitment. If you can stick to that commitment, we might be able to help you in Al-Anon. So I did. I've been coming back ever since. But I did remember that. Six meetings. Give it six, and maybe you'll get something out of it that will want you to come back. So I did that. I started attending Al-Anon, and I was doing that for about, like I said, a month or so, and then we went on that cruise, and my wife was drinking on the cruise and come back, and guess what? Boy, she didn't stop drinking. It just sort of escalated over the next few months. Things really got bad. I mean, her drinking.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Was to the point to where I thought it has escalated to where she would never recover. And I don't know if that's from what I heard through Al-Anon or if that's just something I'm starting to realize. But at that time, I'm realizing that I don't have that same sense of desperation I did when I confronted her the first time, saying, I cannot do this any longer. I think I told myself, I cannot go on the way I'm going any longer, but I have a choice of what I want to do. And I started making plans to proceed for myself and not for ourselves or her. And I think that was sort of changing me a little bit, that says I can't continue, but I can continue for me. And that made all the difference in the world at that time, because she would come home still drunk or stay out and call, and I didn't have that sense of anger and resentment that I used to have. Even though I had that anger and resentment before, I didn't tell her because I didn't talk. You know, that was my part. I just did not tell her all along how I did feel. It was just that obsession with her and her drinking. It had taken me to the point that I was in Al-Anon probably about a year when it dawned on me that, wow, I have changed by coming to Al-Anon and working, that I am not the same person I was. And I was able to, like I tell people, step out of myself and look at myself as a third person and say, wow, this was me before I came to Al-Anon. I was so isolated and alone and so obsessed with this alcoholic that that's all my life revolved around. And the only places I felt safe at one time was at home and at work. And then at the very end, that last 6 months, I didn't even feel safe at home. I didn't want to be there. So work was my only refuge I had. And that made me realize that, hey, the program of Al-Anon was really starting to work for me. I could see that in me, and I could see that I'm not that type of person. I'm changing some, and I want to change more. And that's why I kept coming back to Al-Anon on that. But it was October 28th or something like that of 2007 that my wife had got to the point to where she couldn't go on any longer. She'd been called me. I was at work. She'd called me, and that she said she just couldn't do it any longer. She'd been drinking all night and had taken some pills and that. We took her up to the hospital, you know, had a call to get her into the hospital where she had actually probably suffered from DTs or whatever, disease of alcoholism, you know. And that's a heavy realization. Because here she's going up to the hospital. She is on the High Desert Medical Foundation board, and she's got to go into the hospital and recovering from the disease of alcoholism up there. But that, in the long run, was good. Because I think on October 29th, she decided to make the call to the ABC Club. Later, I learned that she only made that call because she thought that if she went there for about 30 days, maybe I'd get off her back because she had no place to go, you know. So she did go in, and she said 28 days into the program, she didn't want to leave. She was ready, and she spent the 60 days at the ABC Club. And she came out, and she's been actively working the program of AA ever since. But that was her turning point, and that is her story. But it was just a blessing that for some reason everything worked out the way it was supposed to. And I, like I said, spending time with Al-Anon, when I first came in, I didn't talk. It was 6 months, I think, in Al-Anon before I even shared in a meeting. It was probably right at a year before I'd even lead the meeting in Al-Anon, because this is the way I was. I don't get up and talk. I don't share my emotions. My dad and my mom had sort of put that ingrained up in me. This is the way it is. So that I did not do that. But I started sharing at a meeting a little bit, and it wasn't long after that that I'm at work one day, and my coworker, he is in the other program, AA, sitting there talking, and all of a sudden, here comes this lady in, and talking to my coworker, and she says that there was an AA chip on his thing. Oh, yeah, you're an AA. Well, I'm an Al-Anon. And Scotty goes, well, Jim's an Al-Anon. Next thing I know, Kathy's all over me. You know, she said, you know, you got to get down to the district meeting. And I go, what's a district meeting? You know, I'm up in Yucca Valley. I'm at a Tuesday night meeting. That's what I go to. There's only four or six of us there. You know, isn't this what Al-Anon's about? And she goes, no, there's a district meeting down here. We're a worldwide organization. Come on down. So I go down to the next district meeting on that Tuesday night, you know, and sit there. And she goes, well, hey, welcome, you know, Yucca Valley, the Tuesday night Alano meeting. Yeah, okay, you're the GR now. That's for 3 years. You got to keep coming back, you know. So, okay, I'll do it. And I think it was the next month or the month after that, they were holding elections, you know. And she says, hey, we need a secretary. Raise your hand. So, you know, next thing I know, I'm the secretary for the district, you know. And I have still no clue of what a district does or district does anything. But, you know, there is, fortunately for me, somebody that's forceful enough to come in and say, you can do this. So I did it. I went in and tried my best to be the secretary, and after about a year, I finally got it, what I'm supposed to do as secretary. And then about 6 months later, the newsletter editor had resigned because she was moving. And again, Kathy says, raise your hand, you can do that. We'll find a new secretary. So all of a sudden, I'm the newsletter editor now for the district. And that's okay, because all of a sudden, I'm realizing that through Al-Anon, by taking over the position of GR, the secretary, the newsletter editor, getting involved, that service. And that's one form of service that is getting me out of my shell, getting me out of myself, getting me out of my house, getting me out of that one meeting in Yucca Valley that has brought me out. So this last year and a half ago, they were holding the elections again, and it came up for district rep. Well, you know something? Kathy didn't have to tell me to raise my hand this time. I had the courage to do it myself. So service for me works. It gets me here, and that's why I'm speaking here today, because somebody asked for me to be of service, and that's why I can do this. Al-Anon has also made my life a functioning life today and over the last few years, which I don't know how I could have got through the last few years without it. Like I said, our granddaughter was in and out of our house off and on four different times over the course of her her growing up. She's, what, 25 now, living in Texas. She's got her own son. But that same daughter had another child, a son, about 12 years later after our granddaughter. And all of a sudden, we're getting the call that, you know, and the daughter is screwing up again. She's got to go away for 2 years. Can we take the grandson? He's 11. We've seen this son only once or twice a year when we go to Texas for a couple weeks. We don't know this guy, you know. Here he is coming into our house at 11 years old. It's okay, because you know something? I didn't hold the resentment. I said, that's fine. We get to know our grandson. We had him for 20 months. It's good. I liked it. I miss him. He went back Thanksgiving. He's doing well. His mom's doing well because she had that spiritual awakening as well. And over the last couple, 3 years, and maybe that's what we're here all about, is giving people that chance. And she is doing well. He is doing well in his own house with his own mom. So we're very happy that that worked. And we got a chance to know our grandson. He calls us. He says he loves us. He tells us what's going on in his life. He's found a spiritual path to follow too. At 13, he's going out. He's talking to other people about his God and what his God can do for him. And I mean, even to the point, here's a 13-year-old, right, boy. And he said, you know, when he was just first went back there and Thanksgiving and stuff, he'd found the girl down the street. Well, this is his girlfriend and all that, you know. But last month he's calling us saying, you know, I've been talking with our youth group and the pastor and all this. He says, I'm too young for that. I cannot have a girlfriend. God has to be number one in my life. Wow. What amazing. So he's doing well. And that's something that I could not have done, I don't think, if I didn't have the program of Al-Anon that showed me the way that I could accept that son or that grandson into my life and be part of his life and do it with joy and not resentment, because I think that shows through what you how you treat your kids and your grandkids. So that I give that totally to Al-Anon for that. And the other thing in our life going on is that my wife's other daughter, she lives in Yucca Valley. She's married, got two kids, struggling between alcoholism and drugs. You know, both her and her husband You know, he's been a few years ago for the drugs and into drug court for a year and a half and out and clean, doing well. We got a house, put him in the house, pay rent, help fix the house up. You know, you're doing well. Well, that didn't last long. Maybe about 8-9 months, we could just see things deteriorating. He wasn't going to meetings anymore. He wasn't getting out. Our daughter wasn't ever going to meetings until about last May. Then she sort of had an awakening and went to a week detox and came back and out and was doing good for about 4 months. But by that time, he was back out. So when you have a household that never is on the same page, how long does that last? You know, and this went on until we got to the point to where we have to look at ourselves and say, hey, are we still helping and enabling this family to continue doing what they're doing? You know, if they can't pay the rent, so what? No. We have to look at it from the other perspective. They have to be responsible. So, you know, 2.5 months ago, we had to start an eviction process on them out of our own house, their house, for our own kids, you know, to do that because we could not continue to contribute to their disease. And how can we help them if they can't help themselves? And so last week ago, Wednesday, they were officially evicted out of the house. Our kids, our grandson is with us on that right now. And yesterday we went to court. We got custody of our grandson. He's 15. So again, unknown of what's going to happen, but we have him, and it's a joy to have him. It's not the resentment that why didn't they do things right that we have to take this grandson. It's not the resentment towards our daughter that why can't she get this and do this right. We don't have that resentment. You know, my wife has told me that, and I know I don't have the resentment. I just hope that they find the program that can help them. And by us doing this and taking control through the court systems, it gives both of them, those adults, the opportunity to have these programs that are out there that are available to them now. The courts will offer them the 90-day rehab, the counseling, the parenting, if they choose to take it. It is in their court. It is their choice. For us following the actions we had to do to make sure that we felt comfortable in what we were doing, that we were not enabling these kids, we were not helping them continue to do what they're doing and have those grandkids suffer anymore. I'm okay with it because that's what Al-Anon has taught me, to be okay with the choices I make, and hopefully I make the right choices. And for me to make the right choices was, again, through Al-Anon. Because when I was growing up there on the farm, every Sunday we went to church. It was about a 10-mile drive into the church, to the Methodist church there in Breckenridge. And then on that Sunday afternoon, we'd go over probably to the aunt's house where the two my two cousins were, and spend an afternoon with them. But that was our outing, and maybe every other Saturday we'd go in and buy groceries or something. So I grew up in a household that had religion. Come out here, my folks got associated into the church. So even as a young adult, I had a sense of faith in my life, and that was I believed in God. But over the years, that had faded. And especially when I started dealing with the disease of alcoholism, unknowing that I couldn't predict whatever was going on anytime, I was lost. And I had really given up on the hope of prayer and meditation as to help guide me. And it was a year and a half into Al-Anon, going to those meetings every week, that I was looking back at the last year and a half from the time I started into Al-Anon to where I was, and said I could step out of my body again, look at myself as a third person, and say, wow, I have changed. I have been accepting things differently. And why is that? And that sort of opened my heart to God again and let that come in and say, well, it is God's will. If I just let it happen, let it go in God's will, and just let myself do my part and not try to predict the outcome, but be okay with whatever the outcome is, that works. And, you know, all of a sudden life got so much easier. No matter what went on in our household with our kids or anything else, it wasn't to the extent of being obsessed with it. Look at it and say, that's their life. How is it affecting me? Do I want it to affect me? And let it go. And I could go and I could sleep at night and be able to wake up in the morning and everything is better. Everything is better. I shared yesterday at a meeting that I was still working at the time, and I used to get up in the morning about 5 a.m. to go out and make the coffee, sit on the couch, and go over everything that happened the night before at work, or, you know, and what's going to happen today, and try to fix it all and get it all under control, and then drive that 45 minutes down the hill to Palm Springs to go to work. I was already mad and upset and angry at the whole day, you know. And now today I can still get up at 5, get my coffee, sit on the couch, and just sit there and try to have a blank mind and say, whatever happens, it's okay. We'll get through it. And that made all the difference in the world. I did that the last 2 years before I retired. And for some reason, going to work was a whole different experience. Things seem to go so much easier at work now, you know. And through my life, things are so much easier when the ultimate end result is in God's hands and the way it is supposed to play out. It's in His hands. I don't have to have that guilt and that resentment and that anger toward our daughter that is still out there using and having such a disruptive life and not knowing her path. I can't change that. That is up to her. But I can take care of the kid. I can be there for him and hopefully make a change on that end. And hopefully she's got a God of her higher power that can guide her to finding what she needs. Don't know if it's going to happen or not. I cannot predict that. But all I know is today, even like here, when Dave and Nadice asked me to speak, 4 years ago, I would have probably said no. I wouldn't have been up here because I don't talk, you know. So this is how much I have changed, and that is through the program of Al-Anon. So thank you all for being here today, and thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.